If you have an appreciation for honest and often irreverent conversations about parenting humans with neurodiversity, you have found your home. I'm Gwen.
And I'm Kristen. And together we have 35 years experience parenting some fiercely amazing humans, which gives us an endless supply of stories of inspiring failures and heartbreaking wins.
Welcome to You Don't Want a Hug, right? We've been having these conversations for years, cracking ourselves up. We've always wanted to share the hilarity and the hard with other parents, so here we are.
Grab a cozy blanket and a beverage and go hide in a closet nearest you. Morning, Gwen.
Hey, hey, KK.
Hey, hey.
We've had so much fun during the launch of this podcast, haven't we?
It has been a ride. I mean, we've heard from a lot of people from different parts of our life. That's been really interesting. I feel like it's touched a lot of people, and yeah, it's been a blast.
It has been. It's been the most fun for me to have people kind of come out of the woodwork and say, like, as an adult, I just got diagnosed as autism and I can't wait to hear these perspectives. Or my great aunt has been my sweetest one. I don't even know if I've told you this, but she called me one night and just, I mean, if I ever felt bad about myself, now I know to call her. Honey, you are a blessing to this world. You and that Kristen are a blessing to this world. I mean, she started relating to our social isolation piece, not having a child with different abilities. So I've had a lot of positive feedback on people. I can so resonate with that isolation piece because of my experience with X, Y, and Z. And so I've had so much pride in that people's journeys being completely different subject related are just enjoying being able to relate to our experiences. So that universal appeal, I think, is what I am the most excited about, being able to translate that with our listeners.
Yes, I agree. It has been an opportunity for us to think about, ironically, because we feel isolated a lot of the time, how human our experiences and how many ways people can really relate to that.
For sure.
I also think it's a great example of leading through vulnerability. And I felt really anxious about putting ourselves out there into the world this way. But I think that's the thing that resonates with people the most is the vulnerable pieces of it. So it's been really cool.
Yeah. I think we've had to work through that at home here. My husband and I, he's not big on vulnerability or putting himself out there. And I wear my emotions on my face, hands, neck, sleeves, and I'm an open book. So that's been a balance that we will continue to work through. But the feedback is thank you for your vulnerability. Thank you for just being honest about your feelings. And for me, that's not even a thing. So
yeah,
I appreciate, Kristen, that you are being so vulnerable. I am just being myself.
You're just being you.
Yeah. I have to be careful not to be inappropriately vulnerable. In fact, my therapist, Clinton, often says, Gwen, vulnerability for you is silence.
Oh my God, that's perfect. Clinton, I'm using that.
He is always right. And I always want to punch him in the face. Anyway, he listens. So I love him dearly. But yes, vulnerability is silence for me. Okay.
Thank you for your service, Clinton.
Thank you. Can we start off with a Grahamism and a Rylandism, please?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You go first.
Okay. My Grahamism is an oldie but a goodie. I think it's often hard for us to understand what's going on in Graham's brain and how he perceives the world and thinks about himself. Talking about his emotions or how he feels about something is often eludes him, let's say. One day he was just going on a riff. He's great at allegory and using analogies. And he was talking about how his brain works. And this is what he said about himself. He said, sometimes I can't think, like there's a lag, like the computer server is glitching or lagging. I feel like my brain is a giant computer and my eyes are the monitor. My body parts are like the mouse and my heart is like the system bit. It makes the computer run well.
Oh,
I was just typing as fast as I could on my phone as he was telling, tell me more, say more about that. He really has such a different way of thinking about himself, but I thought that was so insightful and interesting.
So if his heart is the bit, if his heart's not in a great place, he's just going to be lagging like crazy.
Right.
Well, and isn't that true for all of us though?
Yeah. Aren't we all just a big meat computer?
Right. But we can cover up the lag.
Yeah.
Whereas our kids can't. That lag is like just right there.
So true.
That's really powerful. I think Rylan and Graham have a way of describing themselves in very similar ways.
Yeah. And just incredibly insightful and thoughtful. And we so rarely get a window in there. And when we do, it feels like a huge gift to know, like, oh my gosh, that's great information for me to know what's going on for you.
So I was going to share a different one, but I think I'll kind of piggyback on Graham's. So my Rylanism is when we were writing his book, it was done during a homeschool semester because we do that as autism moms. We just pull our kids right out of school sometimes. And I did for a semester. It ended up being a transitional point that guided the rest of his school career. So we'll do an episode on that, I think. But he was describing Tourette's and how it feels to have Tourette's. And since we're talking about a rabbit hole diagnosis today, this is appropriate. He goes, well, you know, for me, Tourette's, it's a good thing that my command center, which he describes as his brain, has two joys. Because when my Tourette's hits, that second joy comes up and hits the joy button so that my joy can be stronger than my frustration.
Wow.
And then he drew a picture of it. And I'll post the picture into the show notes because it looks like, and I think he was referring to the movie Inside Out.
Uh-huh.
He really resonated with that movie because he's like, well, yeah, that's exactly what it looks like in my brain. It's a command center. And I just hit that joy button. I have two joys up there.
Oh,
I know.
I need two joys.
We all need two joys. He's always had two joys. So he's very rarely in a bad mood for more than a minute, which sometimes I wish he'd stay in a bad mood for longer than a minute. My mood certainly lasts longer than that. So sometimes I'm like, can we just be grumpy at each other for 10 minutes, please? But he can't. He can't do that. And it's because he has two joys up there. So whenever I see him move on from things, I'm like, oh, shit, that second joy just popped right in there.
I know. I think Graham gets that from my husband, Greg, too, because neither of them can stay mad for more than 2.5 seconds. And I'm like, I need a day. I need a whole day to be mad at you. And that's just not really allowed in our family.
No.
Graham also describes when he gets upset or frustrated in his brain, it looks like SpongeBob. It looks like an office scene.
You're going to have to describe that because I can't SpongeBob.
Well, I really have a problem with SpongeBob. It's just so loud and so crazy and annoying, which actually is, I think what Graham's trying to say is like all of these cartoon characters are running around like in an office scene and it's bizarre and very frenetic. And he said that's what the inside of his brain looks like and that he just has to shut down because that whole scene is playing out.
You know what, Graham? I would shut that right down too.
Ooh, me too.
That's stressful to me to even think about SpongeBob in my brain.
Yeah, that requires medication for me.
Oof. All right. So those were really beautiful Rylanisms and Grahamisms.
Yeah, I feel good about those.
Let's talk about the rabbit hole of diagnosis. That is our topic for today. listeners. And we call it a rabbit hole because I have no idea why. Do rabbits dig holes that go in a lot of directions?
I don't know. Is there like a network of a whole city under there, maybe?
I don't know. Shouldn't that be like an ant hill? Hill of diagnosis?
A termite hill?
Maybe.
Yeah, we just spiral down there.
Why don't you start with a little data around diagnosis? And I think it might be helpful for us to separate the word diagnosis and what it means from a different word that we can propose that our community is tending to lean towards.
Yeah. So a caveat to this conversation is that many autistic people do not want to be referred to as having autism spectrum disorder. They don't believe that that disorder piece is meaningful and actually often think it's harmful to be thought of as disordered because their brains work differently. So that's part of that neurodiversity, social cultural movement. Diagnosis really is a process of determining like the nature and circumstances of a diseased condition. That's the actual definition. And a lot of people whose brains work differently prefer identify, right? So to perceive or state the identity of someone or something really has a different connotation to it. I think that's going to resonate with some people who are autistic or have certain diagnoses or conditions. And for others, it won't, because their symptoms are so significant and impactful that it does feel like a condition or a diagnosis. So different people are going to feel different ways about it, but it's important for you to know that in the disability community, identify would be a preferred way to talk about what we're going to talk about today. So we're going to use all kinds of words, just whatever feels right.
Yeah. I think as a mom, I would have appreciated just having that word thrown out there. You know, we are identifying Rylan as having Tourette syndrome. I think that would have felt softer to me and felt more as a descriptor rather than a label.
Yeah. I have a really good friend who has a child with a rare genetic condition. And when her daughter was born, the doctor called her when she was home. The baby was still in the hospital and said, "You need to come back. I have some really bad news."
Okay.
Exactly. And it was that she had Creutzfeldt-Jakob, which is, you know, a significant condition or trajectory of life. And my friend would have preferred to hear something like, "I have some unexpected news."
Sure. We have identified something about your daughter.
Right. Give the family the opportunity to determine the meaning of that information and how they're going to integrate it into their family lives. So we know that people rarely get one diagnosis. Often it's a journey, and something that we as parents often refer to as the alphabet soup of diagnoses. Through the years, we have both experienced this ourselves, and I know many families that have experienced this, and you really struggle to understand which thing is true and what's meaningful and what's the right fit. A lot of our kids don't fit neatly into a diagnostic box, so it's confusing. It's a confusing experience. According to the National Institute of Health, in a study from 2019, 91% of children and adolescents diagnosed with autism have at least one co-occurring diagnosis, and that's often a mental health diagnosis. Mm-hmm. But constellations of other things are commonly seen with autism, and that includes issues with GI, issues with sleep, seizure disorders, underlying genetic conditions, anxiety, depression, OCD, ADHD. It gets really complicated. And
ticks are a really popular coexisting condition.
Absolutely. Sometimes naturally occurring, sometimes as a side effect of medication. And a lot of times doctors or psychologists don't agree on a diagnosis. And that can really mess with us and how we move forward. I have had experiences with clinical psychologists that didn't agree on an autism diagnosis, and it made it very hard for me to figure out how to think about my own child and how to help them think about themselves.
when they're that young, we are looking to them for answers. Like when we're new to this, they are the sage.
We don't have the self-confidence.
Because we're not armed with what we need to know or how we should approach these conversations. And so we just kind of sit there like children, just kind of gaping at them, like, tell me about my child. And that is, you know, looking back, it was so harmful. And it's not that these doctors are doing anything wrong per se, but we don't have the information that we need to set the stage, to set that launch point for the conversation. And so that's why I feel so strongly about what you and I are doing, because we can help give you that armor to go into these conversations with some confidence in this is a launch point conversation. This is not a diagnostic conversation, is really how I see it now.
Say more about that.
We are not diagnosing what is to come.
Yeah.
We are giving you tools and information, identifying information about why you see what you see in your child. And this is a launch point for moving forward.
I love that.
This is a starting point, but to remove curiosity about your child at the point of diagnosing, it's catastrophic.
It does really narrow your perspective on what you're seeing and what the potential is. It can be a way of, and I agree with you, this is not the fault of the clinical community. This is just a paradigm that's been set up. It's a way for us to think about what we're seeing. I think one of the hardest things to accept is that there's no blood tests for a lot of these diagnoses. This is behaviorally observed. And then you have to wonder how subjective the coding is for assessments. I mean, I think having been a part of research in my own work life, I understand that there are a lot of really sound assessment tools, but they're not the be-all end-all. And a good clinician will never make a diagnosis based on an assessment alone, right? It's a lot of interviews. It's a lot of observation. It's a collection of experiences that lead you to a diagnosis. It should never be just from one assessment.
Which is why there are often waiting lists to be assessed that are years long.
Yeah.
Years. And what's so hard about that is that they're doing their due diligence and making these diagnoses, but that means that kids are losing years of interventions and years of their parents having a better understanding of, okay, what are we seeing here that we can speak into by just waiting?
Yeah. And a lot of our families of color and families who are of different cultures, the tests and assessments are not made with their cultural norms in mind. So when you're doing a test like the ADOS for autism and it's pulling for certain behaviors, but it's using feeding a baby doll, that might not be culturally appropriate for certain families. And so a child might not know what to do with certain things, or blowing out birthday candles, things that just are very normed to our mainstream culture. So
that's a really good example. Not to mention that underserved communities are not on the wait lists because they're not given the tools they need to even know what to do or to have the insurance that will help cover these tests or to have people advocating for their child. So a lot of these kiddos are just going to go misunderstood for a lot longer than their privileged peers.
Correct. And so with a little bit of that background, we have so many diagnoses.
Do we?
That we could discuss.
I forget about them.
I think we would bore the pants off of our audience if we went through all of our experiences. So I'm gonna maybe try and have a collective response to our diagnostic experiences, because it was compounded by having three kids the same age and
all struggling.
Nobody's talking, nobody's pointing, nobody's playing functionally with toys. What are we doing here, folks? What is happening?
Kristen, tell us about the first child to be diagnosed for the first time. Tell us about it.
Oh, it was Hayden. And receiving a diagnosis of autism, I think we were terrified and really sad. Really, really sad.
That was your first diagnosis, autism?
Well, our first diagnosis was Graham having hypotonia from a neurologist, which we thought he must have a tumor or something. What the hell is that? It's really just low muscle tone.
Oh, I mean, is that even need to be diagnosed? Isn't that just a part of every child with autism?
I think it's part of being a Guggenheim because I think I have the same thing. But that was the big, you know, he didn't walk until he was two. He didn't bear weight on his legs till he was like 17 months. So we could tell that there was kind of something going on. OT, Hayden wouldn't pick up any food. You had to feed him. He didn't want to touch anything. So we had OT.
Wait, is that weird? Should they be touching food? Well, didn't touch food till he was like 10.
I know. It's so far, it's been a lifelong relationship with food that's really bizarre for all of our kids. That was the first sign that things were amiss. Were they supposed to eat food that's only one color for the entirety of their childhood, which was beige or orange?
Is it bad that they wouldn't eat solid food till they were three? Is that, or that they would vomit it up if they didn't? Is it weird that we had to feed them in the bathtub so that we could just wash down the vomit? Is that not normal?
Wait, is it bad that we had to feed them baby food fruit because nobody could handle the texture of a fruit or vegetable?
Of course they couldn't.
So anywho,
you can see how though I was like, well, this is normal.
Right. We don't know any different. These are our first kids.
Then Reagan came along eating food and we were like, what is she doing?
She's like eating salmon and snap peas.
She's so advanced, pediatrician. Look at this gifted child. He's like, no.
It's just what kids do. Okay.
Okay, go ahead. Autism is a big diagnosis to get as a first.
It's big. It is big. It feels big. It feels heavy. It feels impossible to wrap your mind around. And then I get another kid diagnosed with autism, and then another kid diagnosed with autism. That felt to me like a shit pile of shame. I felt a lot of shame, not for who my kids were. I didn't feel shame about my kids because they were really freaking cute. It was shame that I've somehow done this to them, that my fertility journey or living near a, what do they call them? A transmitter, or I don't know. Greg being an older parent, having an infection while I was pregnant. There's like 8 ways to Sunday that we could have caused our kids autism. And I went down that path for a while, really blaming myself and feeling that shame and feeling like people were going to judge me.
That's horrible.
It was horrible. And it was a hard piece to move beyond. And I think because we are focused on the deficits when they're young, and we're so focused on, I think about you saying, fix the kid. We've got to fix the kid. That's the focus. And so,
except for you is so many kids. We've got to fix so many kids.
Fix all the kids.
That's a lot of weight.
It is a lot of weight. And I like to show providers, I do some training with providers and parents. And one of the things I like to show them is a spreadsheet of all of the, it's like a table of all of the diagnoses we've gotten over the years for each kid. And then I want them to think about, as a parent, how am I supposed to integrate that information into who my kids are and tell them the story of who they are with those words? That only those words mean limitation is what those words mean. It's what they meant to me. It was painful.
And the words meaning limitation remain that way until we are able to shift our narrative. And that's really hard to do.
It's really hard to do when they're young. When they were in late elementary and middle school, I started to be able to think about what do these labels really mean? And what was really interesting was what they were going to mean to my kids, because they started either rejecting or embracing different labels, which was a fascinating process. And Jameson went through a phase where he really rejected the label of autism. It scared him. It was scary for him. And now he fully embraces it. Graham embraced it pretty early on, and Hayden rejected it outright, which is a really interesting thing. And we'll talk a little bit more about our shared experience, you and I, with Tourette's, because that was the turning point for Hayden, that this cluster of other conditions, which is Tourette's, OCD, and ADHD, which came in when he was about 9,
mm-hmm.
really made a lot more sense to him. And it honestly made a lot more sense to me that he may have been misdiagnosed with autism, or the early intervention created an optimal outcome for him, and that he was no longer experiencing those symptoms of autism. But they really shifted into these other things that were incredibly impactful.
Hey, listeners, this is Gwen. I am here to talk to you about a new service that we are offering through Marvelous Me Books. You've heard Reagan, my daughter, talk about Marvelous Me Books in previous episodes, and this is a service that I'm rather pumped about. The team at Marvelous Me Books knows books, friends. We focus our efforts on hard to find, difficult to talk about, and inclusive titles that meet very specific needs. With each client for this service, we send a questionnaire allowing us insight into the specific needs and experiences of the readers involved. Next, we will curate a list of 101 titles that speak directly to your readers, whether that be a classroom, your own children, grandchildren, a therapy office, and your clients. Each list is going to be completely personalized to your specific readers. And these lists can be accessed through a private link that will be on our store website, where titles can be purchased directly from, or you can use it as a resource to check out books from your library. 10% of all the proceeds from this service will go to one of my favorite organizations, We Need Diverse Books. I would love nothing more than to help you personalize your library, so visit marvelousmebooks.com for more information. I think, though, like when I think back on our years of discussions about like, what is the word for what our kids struggle with, or what is the word that describes our kids? We come back to that so often. So I can remember sitting on your back porch and saying, I think what we're looking at with Hayden is Tourette's OCD. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's Ryland too, Tourette's OCD, which no, I mean, he absolutely has autism. But I was so like clinging to that label of Tourette's OCD as a way to understand my kid. Now I know that that's when the warning signs should start going up. Like if we are looking to a label to help us understand our kid, we're losing sight.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to think about it.
Because we're then looking at, well, what is Tourette's OCD versus who is he? And how does Tourette's OCD impact who he is? But I don't think I was able to shift that until, I don't know, maybe the last 2 years.
Yeah.
And how many years I lost of really appreciating who this kid is. I mean, I always found him hilarious and delightful, but I was so focused on the fixing and the reducing all these behaviors. And I just missed out on so much.
Let's talk about Tourette's in particular, because we have this shared experience. And it, to me, it was one of the most painful experiences as a parent, because it was so visible. And I remember Greg and I sitting at the pool one day, and we were watching the kids playing in the water. And we were watching Hayden nod his head back and forth so violently over and over and over again. He kept having to stop what he was doing to do this really, really vigorous head nodding. And Greg and I looked at each other and just felt like, oh, shit. Like,
What is that?
What is that? What is going on? What are we supposed to do? He would cry at night from the pain. He would have really bad headaches and neck aches. He had a lip-lipping tick.
Oh, yeah, sister.
That created just like this red, raw, cracked, bleeding ring around his lips. He couldn't stop doing it.
It was a permanent part of Ryland's face.
Yeah, for couple years. Of years. Yes.
And people would say, oh, you got to get some chapstick. Do I? Is that what I need?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I should have paid you $10,000 instead of the therapist. Habit reversal therapist. Okay.
Habit reversal training, meds, OCD. Ugh.
Thank God there's chapstick.
Thank God. If only we knew.
If only he could feel the chapstick on his face and be okay with it.
Right.
Yeah. Our first even mention of Tourette's was, and I've told this story before, very good friends of ours in Colorado very nonchalantly just said, hey, do you think that Ryland might have Tourette's? And Tim and I acted as if they just like stabbed us in the eyes and then ripped them out. Because so many people's opinion of Tourette's is that stereotypical, they're yelling the F word and screaming and they're out of control. That is not Tourette's. But
it is Tourette's, but it's a very small percentage of people with Tourette's that have that.
Right. It's very rare, but it's not talked about a lot. Tourette's is not talked about a lot. And so we were highly offended. But by the next morning, I was researching Tourette's because I knew in my gut, like it is something. And well, what is Tourette's? And so I think within a month, we had a neurology appointment at Children's in Denver. And within 10 minutes of sitting in her office, she's like, well, of course he has Tourette's. And we were like, oh, okay. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, are you sure? She's like, well, yeah, he has three different coexisting tics present during our visit in the past 5 minutes. That's Tourette's. And we were like, oh,
okay. I didn't think it was Tourette's. We also went to a neurologist at Children's and I was like, we're just going to rule this out. It's probably some other kind of tic disorder or lots of kids tic when they're in elementary school and then it just goes away. It won't be Tourette's. She was like, it's Tourette's. What? I said, but you need to have vocal tics as well as motor tics. She said, yeah, he's sniffing and he's clearing his throat. Those are vocal tics.
What were kind of the first tics that you saw in him as a little?
Well, now that I look back,
yeah,
because this is what happens, right? We don't notice it when all the other things are going on, but he had an eye blinking tic, and that looks like just really long, squishing your eyes together blinks.
Yep.
That was the first one. And then there was a little bit of a neck roll. And that turned into really violent, like head nodding. That's when things got really, really crazy. And at one point we were thinking we were going to do Botox in his neck, which is so scary to think about. Like if you don't do the right dosage, is his head going to fall off? I don't know. So those were the main ones. Then licking his lips, he would do some things that like pull himself up to the table so that his stomach had to be pressed really hard against the table. And he had some internal like moving of his muscles in his stomach. So some of those tics were internal. We couldn't see them. And then that morphed into when we talk about Tourette's OCD, there were a lot of rules around how he could think about things. And so he had a compulsion to think about things in a very specific order. And he couldn't think about one species of animal until he had finished thinking about the other species. And sometimes he would cry when he was little. He would cry because he wanted to think about chickens, but he still wasn't done with sharks and rays and he couldn't move on. And it was heartbreaking.
I think the tick order is identical.
Really?
Yeah. Ryland started with excessive blinking to the point where strangers would be like, oh, mom, he has something in his eye. No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. Mind your own business. He just blinks a lot and it's cute, okay? Super cute.
Yeah, who asked you?
Do you see how blue his eyes are? They can blink as much as they want to because they're beautiful. So he did tons of blinking. And then he would do shoulder shrugging up and down, up and down. But his vocal tic was a, I mean, we called him the squeaker. He did that.
It was like a hiccup squeak.
A hiccup squeak. He did that. I mean, he would go through phases where he would do that every 10 seconds all day long. We started to not even hear it, but do you think his classmates heard that? Oh, they did. And teachers don't understand Tourette, so we had so much education around, well, he wasn't doing that yesterday, so we think that this is voluntary. Okay. I'm going to send you a quick video on Tourette's. I'm going to need you to watch that. And that's ultimately why I pulled him out of school that semester, because that teacher kept sending him into the hallway until he could control his tics. And I had already educated this teacher. So that's the year where I lost my shit and said, he's out. I'll be back next year. Find me a better teacher for him. And she was a lovely woman, but she didn't understand Tourette's. And she would call him out in front of class for making his sounds as if he could help it. And he would say, that is called Tourette's. I can't. It's like he would advocate for himself so beautifully. So we did really work hard. And then I would make him go at the beginning of every year and talk to his classmates about Tourette's because it was unavoidable. They would hear him the second class started making these squeaking sounds that we thought were adorable, but the kids didn't. I don't know what's wrong with the kids. You don't think like having a little mouse in your room all day long is adorable?
Every 10 seconds?
Right. So the Tourette's ended up being a gift for him because it was a way for him to describe his experience. And then you know who wasn't bothered by his Tourette's? His classmates. Ever his teachers were. But his classmates didn't even notice once they understood.
I think it was harder for Hayden to advocate for himself. Generally speaking, he's such an introvert and is really shy, and the Tourette's was pretty torturous. He also made a lot of animal noises because animals were his special interest. And he would do that at the lunch table. Or one time the teacher, he was in sixth grade. My kids were at a Montessori school. So he had the same teacher fourth through sixth grade. And the teacher let me know, I think Hayden is having maybe some kind of a seizure or something. He's flapping his arms. And I said, well, show me, what do you mean? And so he shows me the movement and I said, oh.
Oh no, he's being a bird.
He's being a bird. He's being a swan, actually. So.
And doing a beautiful job.
And looking amazing, might I say.
In fact, he attracted a group of swans. Did you notice?
In their classroom, they had these two beautiful birds that Hayden, I think, was maybe imitating while class was going on. So that was what was happening. Yeah. So a lot of the special interests interact with the Tourette's. Also, Tourette's, the tics shift over time. So he might have a tic for 6 weeks or 6 months, and then he'll move on to another tic. Or if he's with somebody else with Tourette's,
he takes on theirs.
He'll take on their tics and they'll take on his. One of his closest friends as a kid also had some tics, and they would tic away with each other and pick up each other.
Ryland would get a cold and I always knew, oh shit, here comes a throat clearing tic. Yep. If he gets a cold, he takes on that. And then it's probably a month of that. So it doesn't take much.
Mm-mm. Hayden also has a sniffing tic. That's probably the only one left that's really noticeable. And he just tells people he has allergies and he does the blinking tic. So all that to say, friends, that Tourette's can tend to have a kind of a peak and then really start to mellow out in the later adolescence and into early adulthood. So at 19, Hayden has very few visible tics, the sniffing and the eye blinking and sometimes lip licking. That's a little tongue twister.
Lip licking. I didn't find that hard at all.
Well, you know.
So we can do, I think we should do a whole episode just on Tourette's and talk to the boys about it too. So that will be to come. But when it comes to the rabbit hole of diagnoses, for us, it started with sensory processing disorder. And that was only because his teachers were like, he is not able to sit in his seat or stand in line. God forbid. We think that you should take this sensory processing disorder evaluation, which we did. And it was like, I don't know, 120%. Absolutely. He has sensory processing disorder. We didn't even know what that was. So that's what started it for us. They also had no idea what to do with him once we did find out that it was sensory processing disorder. So we left the school, another episode. But that immediately led to being in this tiny hot attic at this OT clinic and the lady saying, well, he can't do a wheelbarrow. Clearly. I mean, we tried to pick up his legs to do a human wheelbarrow and he just laid his face on the ground. Like, what is it that you're expecting me to do from this position? We were like, Ryland, put your arms up. Well, who can do that? He couldn't even put his arms up to get into the wheelbarrow stance. Well, okay, deficit one. Tim and I were like, crap. I didn't know he was that weak. What else could he not do? Oh, jumping jacks. Yeah, he couldn't actually get his feet off the ground for the jumping jacks. So it just looked like his arms flailing, which we thought was hilarious and cute. But that was a deficit. Oh, he could not hang from a bar. No.
Well, why would you? Why would you?
Still can't hang from a bar. His muscle so bad. He would just fall to the ground and act exhausted. So after that, we were like, well, we had no idea what we were up against. Clearly. No idea.
How is this kid going to get through life not being able to hang up a bar?
Or do a wheelbarrow? You wouldn't believe.
Or jumping jacks.
How many wheelbarrows we've done with him around the house. Like, we're going to nail this wheelbarrow. If we say wheelbarrow, he's like, oh, you know what? If you made me do a wheelbarrow in my house right now, I would kick you in the face. No way. But this was the start of our journey. Those were our benchmarks. How stupid.
It's absurd.
But of course, he couldn't sit in his desk. He was five. And he also did not have anything to play with at his feet. Well, he needs something to play with his feet if you want him to sit in a desk. And he couldn't stand in line because kids were touching him. And that felt like shocks to his body. Anyway, all of this, we were like, okay, we're going to teach this kid to do a wheelbarrow, to hang from a bar, and he's going to be standing in line. Damn it.
Then he's going to be fine.
And he'll be fine. I mean, no, he can't go into an assembly. Can he just stand in the hall? Ryland, come on. Can't you just sit in the frickin' assembly? I mean, these things, Kristen. But that led so quickly to then our pediatrician saying, ugh, sensory processing disorder, that's a bunch of hogwash. OTs, that's not even a thing. Don't even waste your time. And we were like, what? That is so conflicting with what the lady in the attic told us.
Because sensory processing disorder was controversial and not in the DSM-5, by the way.
But you know what he had? Oh, so much sensory issues. I mean.
Oh my gosh.
We brushed that boy's skin every 3 hours for 3 months. But you know what? It helped. He was able to stand in line at the back as the caboose, where no one could touch him.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? That's what he needed from the beginning. We didn't need to brush him to figure that out, but we did. We brushed him. But that led to leaving the pediatrician because clearly we couldn't be working with opposing minds. And that new pediatrician was like, this is not autism. He laughed when I said, is this autism? By the way, laughed at me and said, no, but he absolutely has ADHD, the non-hyper kind. Okay, fine. And then, well, yeah, he has Tourette's, of course. But also the neurologist said in that 5 minutes, oh, I'm pretty sure he has epilepsy. I see him having a lot of absent seizures. So we went down a 6-month rabbit hole, ant hill.
Termite hill.
Over epilepsy. Did you even know we did that?
No, we did it too.
You did?
Two of our kids looked like they were having seizures when they were young, and we had to do the whole thing.
Yeah. Because of course they have abnormal MRIs, because their brains are very unique.
But inconclusive.
Right. Ours was definitely abnormal brain activity. We were like, yeah, no shit.
I didn't need to stick 80 things on his head for us to know that.
And make him stay awake all night to do this test. And then we were admitted to the hospital for a formal sleep study after being told for 3 months that he had epilepsy. And after 2 days in the hospital, the neurologist came in, or whoever it was, and said, he doesn't have epilepsy. This is just abnormal brain activity. You can go home. And I just sat there like, no, you all told us that he had epilepsy. This was the answer to everything. So the fact that I grieved over my son not having a horribly difficult condition makes me ill now.
It's a weird place to be when you feel like you have to argue with people about your child having a significant issue.
I mean, of course we're glad he doesn't have epilepsy. What the fact that that's the place we were in, like, oh, thank God it's epilepsy. No. But so then we had to kind of like, so we grieved that he had it. And then we grieved that he didn't, because we had shifted all of our thinking to, we're going to tackle this epilepsy. And that's why he does all these things. Of course it is. It made so much sense. But no, he's not having absent seizures. He is that distracted all the time. And then the autism didn't come until he was, what, 10, 11? Is that when I was a fellow? That's when he got his autism diagnosis.
Do you remember? I remember when PANDAS came up and you felt like, this is the answer. He doesn't have autism.
It's PANDAS.
He doesn't have Tourette's. It's PANDAS. And it was painful to watch you go through that, knowing that you were going down a rabbit hole. It was like, oh, friend, I see it. I'm watching you, and I am you. I know what you're doing. And it was hard because you spent a lot of money. You did a ton of research. And ultimately, I don't think it got you anywhere better.
No. And for our audience, like, PANDAS is this very controversial diagnosis that I don't know if it will ever not be controversial, because it's just not scientifically proven, and they can't like medicate for it. And it involves a reaction to a strep infection, and the strep infection gets caught in the body. And so it causes all this inflammation. And it's interesting, but we spent months, like, we drove him to Chicago to go to a specialist there. And we had all of this blood work done. And we were, it was so controversial that a neurologist at Children's said, off the record, you need to look at PANDAS. And so we did. And then she ghosted us. Well, then it turns out she got in big trouble for mentioning PANDAS to a client or to a patient. And they called us with her manager in the room, and she took back what Wow. she said. And it was the most awkward. I said, but you told us that the blood work showed. She goes, I didn't. It was so uncomfortable. So even these diagnoses are so, within the medical community, so confusing. So what are we supposed to do with that as Yeah. parents? I found specialists to talk to. I still believe that he probably has a lot of inflammation in his brain, And a lot of the PANDAS research is interesting and makes sense based on an infectious staph infection that he had as a baby. And that's really when we started seeing all this stuff. But it still just is what it is. And if I spent my whole life trying to focus on that, I'm just missing out on him.
Right.
So we ended up right where we started with he's Rylan. His brain works really differently. Read the book and you can understand him better. I'm out.
The end. We had an experience where people didn't think Graham had autism. Most people thought he did. Isn't that hilarious? Most people did. Some clinicians did not. I had one clinician say, I think he has a language disorder, executive functioning disorder, and sensory issues. I was like,
those are all autism.
That's autism. Like, what is the difference? And the problem is that that is such a nuanced, intellectual, hair splitting difference that I can't go out into the world and tell people those are the things.
No.
Nobody will know what that is. And we as families, I think, go through periods of time where disclosure, we over-disclose, we under-disclose. I finally realized I need to tell the lifeguard at the pool that this kid has autism and he's not going to hear you if you give him a lot of verbal direction. So
sing it.
Yeah, sing it. Hold up a sign that says no splashing.
Yeah, laminate it because it's a pool.
That's right.
Because we have to go out into the world and tell people.
Right.
With our kids, we have to tell people about them or it doesn't go well. If we want to do anything outside in the world, we need to have language to describe our kids. And so that's the part of labels and diagnosing that I appreciate, because when we were able to say, hi, Rylan's doing your little soccer camp today, he has autism. Bam, I'm out. They looked at me and said, oh, okay. Because you know what that did? It described any quirky behavior that they saw. They were like, well, he has autism. Explained. Done. Before that, I was like, okay, he's going to react to this way. He might do this. If he says this, if he makes noises. And it was an hour long sit down conversation that I was able to eliminate when I could just use the word autism. So for that purpose, I love being able to use that diagnosis as a descriptor, but I will never allow it to be a definer.
Yeah, that's such a great differentiation. I think that's enough for us today, friend. I think we should let our kids talk a little bit.
Yeah, I don't even think we've really scratched the surface on what it's like to get all these diagnoses. I don't think we've even scratched the surface because, like we said, clearly it's a rabbit hole.
Love to hear from some of our listeners what their experiences have been on the website if you want to comment. And we're also going to post, Gwen wrote a beautiful piece on the finality of a diagnosis that you will be able to see as well.
All right. We're going to hand it over to our kids. See you guys next time.
We know our moms are amazing, but they don't know everything. We think that you deserve to hear from the real expert, their kids. Woohoo! We believe in nothing about us without us. So here it is, the last word.
Hey, Rye.
Hi.
So we would love to hear from the kids what you think it means to be diagnosed with something. What do you think that means?
Basically, a doctor just telling you what your condition or like mobility or like sickness is, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like diagnosed can also be used for like sickness.
True.
So that's why it's, yeah.
Do you think that that's a good word to use for like getting diagnosed with autism or getting diagnosed with Tourette's? Do you think that's a good word to use or would you rather use a different word?
I don't care what they call it.
You don't?
Nah.
It doesn't bother you?
No.
Okay. Can you talk about what it feels like to have a diagnosis of Tourette's?
I'm not sure what you mean by that question, Counselor.
What do you think about the fact that you have a diagnosis about Tourette's?
I don't really, I just feel normal.
Okay. Do you ever even think about it?
No.
You don't?
No.
What about if you're having a really bad tick day? Do you think about it then?
I guess. I just don't want people to laugh at me.
Yeah. But do you have any negative thoughts about having that as a diagnosis? Or do you just kind of not have much thoughts about it?
Not much thoughts.
Okay. What about having a diagnosis of autism? How do you feel about that?
Don't think about it that much.
You don't?
No.
That's amazing. Why do you think you don't think about it very much?
Just normal for my life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is normal for your life. Do you think that a lot of kids with autism think about their autism, or do you think most kids are like you and don't think about it much?
I don't know what other people think, but I know what I think.
That's a very fair answer. Yeah, you kind of called me out on that one, didn't you?
Because I don't live in other people's minds.
That's true.
I don't know what they think about. Can't read minds. None of us can.
Thanks, buddy. That's a fantastic answer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. This has been a really great mumbly sort of conversation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I just want to really thank you for the teenage boy.
No.
Jameson, today we talked about the rabbit hole of diagnoses and how it can kind of mess with our brains in terms of how we think of ourselves and each other. I'm wondering if you have a memory of your autism diagnosis and what that meant to you.
I guess the big one is that I didn't know. Well, I mean, I guess I kind of didn't know, but I technically was diagnosed with autism when I was 4, but I don't remember any of that because a lot of my childhood was just compressing that and just like, oh yeah, no, I'm quirky or, you know, something like that. I ended up getting diagnosed my freshman year of high school. And I remember it being like, excuse my, you know, poor choice of words, but like traumatic, because most of my life I'd grown up around a lot of ableism and a lot of, you know, like harmful ideas of what autism is and like, you know, the way that like, you know, quote unquote special ed kids are treated, where like, you know, it's just like kind of like thrown in the corner, don't want to be dealt with or anything. So I remember specifically that like in that moment, it did make a lot of sense for like certain things, like having to, you know, like stop myself from like stimming in public and like, you know, honestly, that was more exhausting than it is, you know, now, because I was basically like masking with it too, denying that I had autism. So I was like, oh, well, what's wrong with me? So I think, and the way that it changed me, I think, is that I think like something structured, like a diagnosis like that, kind of keeps me grounded, if that makes any sense.
It does kind of give you a structure for how to think about.
Yes.
Your differences?
Yeah, where, you know, whereas before I was diagnosed with autism, whenever I would have a meltdown, whenever I'd be like, I don't understand these social situations, all that kind of stuff, it just made no sense. It went out in one ear, went out the other, never really processed it. And it just felt like, oh, if I confront these, then that means I'm some kind of like, you know, medical mystery, if that makes any sense.
But then having the diagnosis made you able to understand why those things were hard.
Yes, it definitely sucked. It sucked a lot, but it was able to help me start unmasking. And now I can, you know, I'm still working through quite a lot, but I have good friends that are, you know, understanding about it. But like, you know, not having to mask it anymore is honestly easier than having no diagnosis.
Oh, hey, Reagan.
Hey.
How's it going, girl?
Good.
Kristen and I recorded an episode today about getting diagnosis for our kids, and we would love to hear about the kids' perspective on what does it feel like as a kid to go through the process of getting a diagnosis. Do you have anything that you can say about that?
I don't know.
Yeah? Do you ever think about your own diagnosis of dyslexia?
Not really.
Why not?
Because it doesn't come to my mind.
No?
No.
That's great. What are times that it might come to your mind?
When I have to read in front of the whole class.
Oh, yeah. It would totally come to my mind. But other than that, it just doesn't really faze you?
Not really.
Awesome. Do you think
now it, back to the Dudley part.
Now back to the Dudley. Anything else about Dudley you want to share?
He's a fluffy poofball.
He is a fluffy poofball. All right. Well, Reagan, this has been a fantastic addition Reagan's to the last word. Okay.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of You Don't Want to Hug, right? We'd sure love it if you'd subscribe to our show and your favorite podcast app. Missing an episode would be catastrophic.
And if you just can't get enough of us, join our newsletter and dig into all of our other projects and ways you can connect with us at youdontwantahug.com.
And food for thought. If you need to create a panic room out of your closet in order to find that parenting kindness, we offer our fullest support. See you next time.